Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Jeff Kempeners, Chief Technology Officer for Avodot Canada Solutions. Jeff is a top-ranking business strategist and technology leader. Jeff, you bring a lifetime of proven top-ranking international business and technology leadership to our audience. Considering your heavy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, considering your background and the expertise you have in so many areas, what do you see as the outlook for unified messaging?
So unified messaging is a term that we're using to describe a very specific set of features combining services such as email, SMS, fax, voice, video, voicemail, instant messaging, etc. So if you think of the sort of parsing the term unified messaging, what we're doing is unifying the messaging experience. And today we're doing messaging in a variety of ways. It could be everything from voicemails to emails to instant messages and so forth. As that messaging experience begins to become unified, what we're then able to do is hop over from an instant messenger session and instantly add video and voice, potentially across multiple parties and multiple locations without the need to dial into to a conference bridge, things like that. Once you add some application sharing and a topic, then you've got basically a general purpose collaboration tool. So to answer your question specifically about the outlook of unified messaging, I would say it's going to become part of the building foundation upon which we start to recompose business processes in order to better leverage concepts like digital collaboration and workflow. I don't necessarily think of unified messaging in and of itself as a business solution. Certainly, it's a general enabler of collaborative technologies, and generally and broadly speaking, it should enable some degree of efficiency in your information worker groups. However, where the real interesting things begin to happen is when you take that unified messaging experience and start to redesign or recompose your business processes leveraging those new features.
You know, it's interesting you talk about this because I just completed an interview with one of the top leaders in business and technology, and he indicated in his organization one of the key drivers for the future is just having this sort of seamless integration and this ability to communicate and be anytime, any place, anywhere. So this unified messaging concept seems to tie into that need.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and certainly the unification of the messaging is what makes it key there, the ability to seamlessly identify an individual rather than a device and contact that individual in the manner that's most appropriate for that individual at that specific point in time. So that is to say, rather than trying somebody on their mobile phone, maybe then trying them at their work desk, sending them an instant message, and then finally an email if I haven't been able to get any of sort of the more synchronous methods accomplished, you know, rather than going through that experience as an end user, I would like the technology to tell me what's the best way to contact somebody at this point in time. Are they currently busy in a presentation? It should automatically notify me that email is probably my best option. You know, likewise, if somebody's already on the phone, I'd like to know that they're already on the phone so that rather than trying to contact them via voice, I might default back to instant messaging and so on. And so that presence awareness and that, you know, awareness of an individual and what it is they're currently doing in a communications environment sort of opens up new doors for seamlessness in how we communicate with one another.
Jeff, one of the things I'm hearing from business leaders is this whole concept of enterprise content management. Sometimes there's confusion of what it's about. Can you talk about the value of content management and what it means?
So content management from an enterprise perspective or enterprise content management is there are a lot of opinions in the value that this brings, and it certainly depends on who you ask on what value is returned by ECM. Broadly speaking, in the past, the value around enterprise content management has been in things like versioning, access control, administration capability, and one that's very near and dear to me, which is enabling of search. And we'll key on that in just a moment, but what's really interesting is where we go from here, because search is, in my opinion, one of the most impactful technologies of a generation, and now suddenly document management repositories are exploding with content because users know that they can search for their stuff in there, right? So just to put a finer point on it, what used to be stored in shared drives or in public folders or just dumped on your own hard drive or in any variety of other places, people are finding that what we're finding is that people are putting these documents into a document management repository just because it then allows them to search for their stuff later. So you're seeing document management merging with document-centric collaboration in places such as Microsoft Office, SharePoint Server, many sites within workflows, so it's sort of a growing space. Now, my opinion is that the overwhelming majority of users prefer to dump their work in a relatively small set of very unorganized, coarsely categorized folders, and present company included there. That's why search is crucial to so many of us. We're disorganized creatures by nature, or at least the majority of us are. So we have this tendency to leave finished work scattered behind us in a wake of forgotten shared drives and email threads, and that's part of our very nature as information workers and knowledge workers. And I think that'll continue with many sites for collaboration. It will continue within document management if that's the only place people can go to get search or to get the ability to find work product from themselves and from other individuals in similar roles that was completed in the past. So now the question is, how do we build around that? You know, knowing that that's sort of a human nature concept, I say use each tool for its intended purpose. Document management is one version of the truth. It's access and version controlled, approved for our viewing pleasure from, you know, up on high. You know, then provide another location, a repository of sorts that contains work product from the masses, and make that searchable, put up wikis, let people blog, post documents, collaborate, define what they choose to share and with whom they choose to share it, and sort of create a digital community for what I call draft documents or work product from information workers. So when we think of enterprise content management, I think eventually we will move back to the space where ECM hosts corporate official documents, things that are, you know, public press releases, for example, HR policy documents, quarterly sales reports, the types of things that you are looking for the one single version of the truth. And we will start to take away from the ECM space those things that are currently a poor fit for ECM, which is just leveraging its search capability. And so I believe that enterprise content management will continue to be misused as a means to make documents searchable for at least some time in the near future. But once ECM does go back to its roots and we've evolved our digital communities and digital collaboration to the point that separation is a natural thing and we've got these online digital communities again, then I believe ECM will move back to its original space and its original value proposition, which is versioning, access control, administration capability, and, you know, of course, enabling search. And ultimately, that drives toward the single version of the truth.
You know, earlier you talked about collaboration, so can you explain how collaborative workspaces improve all of the elements of business agility?
So let's define collaborative workspaces as the space in which an information worker spends his or her time, right? So it has all the same stuff we're used to. It's got a phone and a PC and a desk and a chair. You know, maybe there's a webcam, maybe not. Now, that space in which an information worker works, just want to be clear that, you know, this is how I'm defining collaborative workspaces. I think we could talk about collaborative mini sites and, you know, and sort of digital collaboration environments, but I'm talking about the workspace as a set of hardware and a physical space that really we already have. Now, let's run through a quick scenario. Let's say I choose to collaborate with somebody else who's halfway around the world. The two of us have a topic that we're going to collaborate around. Each of us has a job function. There's sort of a point in time understanding that this is what we're here to discuss, this is what we're here to solve, this is who you are, this is who I am. And the reason why I call that out is because all of that is really metadata in a way. So once we've created a unified messaging environment, now we've enabled a way for Stephen and I, to use you and I as an example, to collaborate around a specific topic. But where is that captured? And this goes to a concept that I've really been pushing recently, and I call it collaborate and capture. Because collaboration is not just about a point-in-time communication between two individuals, but rather it's about two individuals collaborating around a topic, and then the product of the collaborative session is captured digitally and made searchable such that other individuals are able to leverage our collaboration session at some point in the future. So that's where it gets very interesting to me. And collaborative workspaces, in my opinion, is a way to enable all of this. I'd like to see built into the fabric of our applications, built into the business processes of how we run our businesses, I'd like to see the ability to, as Stephen and Jeff complete their collaboration session, with one click of the mouse and maybe a couple of keywords around additional metadata, we're taking the document that we collaborated upon, a few blurbs of information about the instant messaging session that we had, Potentially a little bit of a wiki gets stood up that we've sort of been typing around and determining what it is we're trying to solve. And then all of that metadata about who is Steven, who is Jeff, what are our job functions, what day and time did we collaborate, and what was the topic of our collaboration, all of that then becomes metadata that allows a search engine, other individuals then are able to find the product of our collaboration. And that's when the sort of the efficiencies really start to become interesting. So my opinion on collaborative workspaces is that it's not just about enabling two individuals, but rather it's about enabling a knowledge management repository to grow in such a way that other individuals can leverage previous collaborative sessions.
You know, getting to the question again in terms of business agility, do you have a definition of business agility?
I do, and it's an interesting concept because one of the things that I've noticed is that there are many companies who would profess that they don't necessarily need agility, and other companies that live or die by the agility sword. And so I define business agility as your ability to make change commensurate with the market that you're attempting to serve, and in some cases, ideally outpacing the market that you're trying to serve. Certainly, we in Canada take the approach that we're looking at what our counterparts are doing in the U.S., and we have a tendency to very pragmatically determine what is working, what is not working, and make our decisions accordingly. And so I make that point because I believe that much of our agility in Canada is centered around what is working and what is not working in the U.S. And then it becomes a time-to-response issue. It's relatively clear what's working and what's not working by the time we're willing to invest in it in Canada. And so then the question becomes, how equipped are we to make those changes effectively and efficiently, move them throughout the organization, handle them both technically and from a journey management perspective, and implement those new processes across our organization? Now, in the States, it's a little bit different. You know, certainly they're much more open to experimentation around agility. And so the way folks in the U.S. tend to define agility is it's about the ability to put rapid change in the hands of the people who define their business. The ability literally to experiment oftentimes, launch new products and financial services, create a dynamic order of load for a coal mining facility. Let's say I'm in manufacturing and I've got only so much material left to fulfill five orders, and a sixth order comes in. I would like to be able to, in an agile manner, reassign the total amount of each of those five loads so that I can meet the sixth order quickly and seamlessly contact the other five individuals and let them each know that they're getting 50 tons less each than their order, automatically update the pricing system to give them best pricing, regenerate the invoices and purchase orders, realign logistics and shipping, all of that in as seamless a manner as possible. Now, that sounds like a very arduous task to somebody who's sort of manually working many of these processes. But if I've built a lot of those IT infrastructure tools, and in many cases that involves collaborative tools as well, then hopefully that process is much more attainable, and that's what gives you business agility.
You know, Jeff, earlier you talked about search. So what does enterprise search mean to the user and ultimately to the business?
So earlier we talked about search in the context of finding documents in an enterprise content management system, and people more and more are talking about replacing the term search with the term find. I don't necessarily believe that that's going to happen. I think that search is, a term that is near and dear to far too many people, but I think that the point is very simple. Get what you're after as quickly as possible. Whatever that may be, it could be a factoid, a graph buried in an Excel file, a phone number, the name of the regional sales manager for Lower Manitoba, whatever it is you need outside the scope of just documents. And the implications here are really obvious, and it really is get what you need and get it now. Now, the hard part is in implementation and measuring the return on investment as you go further and further down the path. And I would argue that many companies are way behind the curve here and have not even defined the beginnings of a strategy, which really begins with ranking the features and measuring investment versus anticipated return. So, first of all, what's available to us in an enterprise search manner? What types of things can we search, what structured and unstructured data, how can we better serve our audience, and create that feature list. And then measure investment heft versus anticipated return on each of those items, and then stack rank them according to low-hanging fruit versus, you know, high-cost, low-value all the way at the bottom of the stack rank. And then add a timeline to that stack rank, and you've effectively got a roadmap. It's not rocket science, but we're sort of falling behind. And I think this is proven by the fact that in the consumer-based web and applications, search is ubiquitous and amazingly accurate. Think of the applications that you use at home, your media players, your consumer devices, websites. Everything has search, and search is amazingly accurate and amazingly fast. Now, then you get to work, and it's not at all like that. You sit down in your office, you log onto your enterprise portal, you're digging, you know, 15 file menus deep into a shared S drive out on a file share somewhere in order to launch the documents that you work on day to day. So Avanade is a process that can get a company started down that roadmap, and any journey begins with the first step. But the key here is to honestly compare the digital environment in your company to what you know it could be, and then endeavor to do something about it. Ultimately, the enterprise search means high degree of efficiency, the ability to get what you're after without any search whatsoever. And I think that's why people keep going back to the term find. We shouldn't have to search. It shouldn't take us long to search. We shouldn't have to traverse folders, multiple websites, etc. Enterprise search is about a single place that I can type a structured set of keywords. It will search multiple repositories, Moss mini sites, or, you know, SharePoint mini sites, collaborative sites. It will search document repositories, enterprise content management repositories, email threads, even for discussion groups, all sorts of different places, and it will bring back to me that which it thinks I'm the most interested in.
Again, ties into business agility. People need the ability to make decisions quickly, and they need access to that right information at the right time.
Indeed, indeed.
You know, what is meant by workplace transformation vehicle?
So earlier we talked about unified messaging becoming part of the plumbing or a fixture and how that leads to a generic set of tools for collaboration. And because, well, a workplace transformation vehicle, in my view, is an opportunity to recompose your business processes because of those new technologies to sort of gain a real advantage from a business process perspective. Now, I want to key on a phrase there, and it's recompose business processes. Now, some people use the term business process reengineering. That just makes it sound hard. At the end of the day, what it is we're really doing here is we're recomposing our business process. It's the same exercise that we went through when the telephone first hit the desk and we stopped sending telegraphs to one another. It's further than that, it's what happened when email replaced the paper-based memorandum. It's what happened when fax became ubiquitous. It's what will continue to happen as new collaboration and unified messaging is brought into the mix. So as we have new ways to communicate with one another, we are then redesigning the business processes that leverage those communications. And that's a workplace transformation vehicle. So examples of these opportunities often manifest themselves because of some specific threat. That is, the technologies exist, but the threat or cost of doing nothing becomes a known issue, and often it's the capture of knowledge to mitigate the risk of losing key staff members that is one of the major risks that is seen as a reason to go ahead with a workplace transformation. For example, retirement, attrition, enable an outsourcing arrangement with a new business partner. These are all very good reasons to transform our existing workplace environment from sort of the old business process based on an old set of tools, which really includes email, telephone, fax, and moving forward into a more unified messaging environment and building or recomposing your business processes on top of those new technologies.
So we talked about different sort of elements of what's happening out there from a business standpoint, from a technology standpoint, and I would say integrated into this is, you know, the changing dynamics in terms of demographics, you know, like Gen Y and all of that. So how do all of these elements weave together into the next generation workplace?
Key here is to acknowledge that all of the advantages of next generation workplace, or what we sometimes abbreviate NGWP, are available for companies who choose to take them. All of those advantages are there. You just have to conscientiously make the decision to leverage those advantages. So all these technologies exist, but truly the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The unified messaging, collaboration, business insight, crowdsourcing via wikis, challenges to the community of information worker for, to achieve research goals. These types of things are available. Other companies are doing them today. Everything needs to be searchable in a secure, managed environment. And that sort of that underpins the vision of the next generation workplace. It's collaborative. It allows business insight via business intelligence. It enables crowdsourcing via wikis and via challenges. And it has unified communications and unified messaging as the core beneath it all. That all enables a searchable, secure, managed environment. So Avanade combines the entire Microsoft stack of products into a solution upon which you can recompose your business processes. And that's sort of the point of next-generation workplaces. How do we weave all of these things together in such a way that it allows you to recompose business processes and gain real business process efficiency? And once you've rewoven the tapestry of your business to leverage next generation of tools available today, then you've really arrived at a next generation workplace.
See, I imagine that this is going to produce some sort of what I would call disruptive changes in terms of even strategic planning.
I used the term earlier that search is one of the most impactful technologies of a generation, and typically the phrase that I use is that search is one of the most disruptive technologies of a generation. Now, disruptive doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing, but certainly it will have a very broad impact on a wide variety of things. That is to say, it is to information workers, search is to information workers what the digital camera was to film manufacturers. It's time to get on board, or certainly your competition may overlook you. It sort of reminds me of a story, and if you'll indulge me, I'm not sure if it's true or if it's a fable, but the story goes that in the early 1900s, all of New York went dark. They lost electricity, they lost power. This went on for several days. During the course of those couple of days, there were hordes of engineers coming in and out of the power station attempting to get the main systems back online. Now, in the early 1900s, there were not a lot of electrical devices, so it wasn't as huge an issue as it would be today for a multi-day failure, but still, as it started to get over 48 hours, it started to become a pretty serious issue. And they finally decided, based on the advice of their chief engineer, that they needed to call John. And John's the guy who retired 2 years ago, and John is, off fishing somewhere, and, John's the guy who can fix this. Don't worry about it. Just call John. Get him in here. So John comes in the next morning. He takes one look around, kind of sniffs the air pensively, walks around behind a giant, a giant substation, wraps twice very soundly with a wrench on a solenoid, and throws a switch, and all the power comes back on throughout all of New York City. Now that's obviously a pretty valuable individual. He goes back to fishing, and about a week later they get his invoice in the mail, and the invoice is for $1,000 and 2 pennies. And curious, of course, the controller called John and said, hey, what's with the odd amount on the invoice? And he said, well, I charge $1,000. I charge 2 cents, 1 cent per tap, and $1,000 for knowing where to tap. So the moral of the story is, tapping is cheap, practically free. You can rap all over the world, but knowing where to tap, that's the information that's trapped inside of each individual's head inside of your organization. And the ability to collaborate and capture, the ability to search on those previous collaborative techniques previous collaborative sessions, the ability to maintain a body of knowledge that is the institutional knowledge of how your power plant runs, or how your financial services cross-selling activities take place, or any number and variety of other things that are core and crucial to your business. There are people in your organization who know where to tap. They may choose to leave someday. They may retire. You may lose them for attrition. You may choose to outsource their job to a third-party vendor, either onshore or offshore. There are a variety of reasons why the people who know where to tap may not be around when you need them at some point in the future, and that's why you need to really leverage what they know, capture what they know, in order to really mitigate the risk of employee transformation.
I love that story about John. Can you share any other stories that illustrates the areas we discussed?
Well, I think that one really illustrates it well. I would I maybe tell it again and not screw up the punchline quite the same way. But yeah, I think that one really does tell it well, because at the end of the day, it really does illustrate that it's not just about your ability to implement. It's not just about your ability to stand up a unified messaging environment or have, shared storage for unified communications, or even have a great email system that's integrated with your voicemail system, so that when somebody leaves me a voicemail, it gets forwarded to my smartphone as an MP3, and I click it into place. All of that's great, but all of that is tapping. At the end of the day, knowing where to tap, at the end of the day, knowing how to recompose your business processes, knowing how to capture the knowledge that's in everybody's head, that's the value. That's the part that John charged $1,000 for. And that's the part that really is what next generation workplace is all about. You will still save pennies in just sort of general collaboration and the ability to gain general efficiency in your information worker camp, but that is really just pennies. The big value comes in your ability to re-engineer and recompose your business processes on top of those new tools.
Jeff, at this point in the interview now, we're going to shift gears a bit, and we're going to sort of rely on this aspect that you are this internationally renowned business and technology leader, and we're going to tap into that expertise. So what do you see as the top opportunities and innovations in IT, and how can they be exploited for competitive advantage?
Obviously, I think number one for me, and these are in no particular order, but the first one that I'll mention is search. I do believe that it is a tremendous opportunity to implement enterprise search and gain real efficiencies. And anyone who studied macroeconomics knows that even though maybe we're just saving pennies or seconds or minutes, as you multiply that across an entire organization, you can start to realize some real benefits. And I think we've talked about that, quite thoroughly. I'd like to add to that the concept of digital collaboration and capture, right? And I'm talking about, collaborate and capture as a very key phrase there, because I want to reiterate that it's not just about your ability to collaborate individual to individual or one to one or one to many or many to many, but rather it's about the ability to capture those sessions and have other people leverage that knowledge later without the need to have the original two collaborators involved. And then I'd add to that SOA, or service-oriented architectures, which is often discussed and in some cases causes some people a little bit of heartburn. There are widely varied success and failure stories all over the world around service-oriented architecture, and I think at the end of the day it comes down to service-oriented architecture is also going to be part of the plumbing. It's a way to combine applications much more seamlessly. I think of it sort of like unified messaging for your application stack. It's the ability for your applications and your middleware to talk the same language to one another. And I find that maybe it's not a prerequisite, but certainly it's an enabler for a lot of future things that we're all attempting to do. And one of those future things is the next item I list, which is dynamic computing and software as a service and sort of computing in the cloud is what many people are calling it today. And that is that's sort of an interesting concept that, SaaS or software as a service, some people are using the term solutions as a service, others still are still sort of traditionally calling it like a hosted outsourcing environment. All of those are technically accurate. I think what we're doing is we're narrowing down definitions according to what makes the most sense, both from an industry group perspective as well as for a functionality perspective. And I would see dynamic computing growing substantially over the course of the next couple of years. Now, where is that an innovation in IT? I'm not necessarily recommending that large IT organizations start to wholesale outsource their IT environments. But what I am saying is, treat your own end users, departmental users, or even at an enterprise scale, treat them as if you are a software as a service provider and they are software as a service consumers. And what that does is it is, you know, SaaS is sort of opening up new models for costing, pricing, multi-tenancy, shared environments, better use of servers and storage and so on. And we're learning a lot in the way that SaaS providers are standing up their environments and reselling their environments to small and mid-market companies. The enterprise then can use that knowledge, can stand on the shoulders of what we've learned about SaaS in the lower and mid-markets, and can basically be their own SaaS providers within their own four walls. It may still be on-premise, it may still be in the data center, hosted and managed by your own employees, but now maybe the way that we're charging, you know, charging end users is per login, per session, depending on the amount of data that they use, the amount of throughput that they use. So we're sort of putting new utility-style models into on-premise applications that used to be seen as traditional applications, but we're sort of applying a SaaS and utility computing model to that. And I think that that does an interesting thing in the way that we assign costs and then realize cost benefits over some degree of time. And then the last one I'll throw out there is CRM. Or customer relationship management, and it's with some hesitancy that I throw that out there, because I know, you know, if many people who tried CRM, particularly, you know, it, you know, 8 to 10 years ago when it was really sort of in a big flush, probably has the scars to show for it. You know, the lesson here is that it's much easier to do CRM implementations today than it was in the past. One of the past points of view was CRM has to do everything, so CRM needs to be all things to all people. We need to include campaign management, supply chain management, supply relationship management, potentially, you know, including financials and reporting capabilities and all the stuff in the box in your CRM app, and it turned into this big, giant, unmanageable ERP-sized set of applications. And what we've migrated to recently is, rather than seeing it as a set of applications, we're seeing it as a set of services. And that's sort of validated by, you know, that's been Microsoft's approach with Microsoft CRM for several generations of the product, but we're seeing that approach validated as other CRM providers, and in many cases some of the more traditional CRM providers, are coming to market with a story that says our latest version is SOA ready, SOA enabled, and allows you to consume CRM data services. Now, why that's interesting is now, rather than putting all of your other applications inside of the CRM box, what you're doing is exposing the CRM data as a set of services that can then get their fingers into all sorts of other areas of your organization. So you can leverage that CRM data via a service call from your point of sale software, from your call center software, your folks who are collaborating around the best way to cross-sell a financial services product, that's been recently launched. They can, you know, in the analysis dashboard where they're running scenarios and financial modeling, they can pull up CRM data in real time and model those scenarios around target audiences. These are the types of things that we're seeing more and more of as CRM becomes a real differentiator for businesses that wish to deepen their existing relationships and, more importantly, wish to start to steal market share from their competitors. So I would say CRM, like I said, with some hesitancy, because I know many of us have been burned by this in the past, but I think it's high time to take another really hard look at CRM, because there is a much different approach to it now.
Can you delve into the top five risks for businesses and how they could be resolved?
So we talked earlier about agility. I would argue that a lack of agility certainly may be a potential risk for many people. Sometimes companies are bought out by a larger competitor who's innovating more, attracting more customers, performing better, et cetera. And that sort of leads to one that I want to key on, and I really can only think of two risks, because I think, you know, the rest of them depend heavily on industry segment and, you know, what's your core business and where do you sit in your competitive set. But two that I think are pervasive is, one of them is agility, as I mentioned. The other is the ability to attract top talent. And I know that that doesn't sound like a very IT-centric thing, but, please bear with me. I came from a process consulting background. This goes more deeply than one might realize. So as I mentioned, sometimes companies are bought out by a competitor who's innovating more. Sometimes they're attracting more customers and growing faster, performing better. And often that starts with the employees. So we readily admit that attracting top talent implies an advantage. And what we often fail to acknowledge is thus it is also a disadvantage if we're unable to retain the best people. So I'm going to put a finer point on it in saying that today the younger workforce, specifically age 25 and below, probably had broadband, mobile phones, PCs, literally since they can remember. They probably had it all through high school, all through university, and are now at a point where this technology is just ubiquitous to them. They know how to turn ideas into keywords and keywords into search results that yield answers. They want to be as productive at work as they are in their personal lives, and sometimes that means better search, availability of wikis, ability to collaborate, access to information. And these are the leaders of the future that we must nurture to take the reins of our organization someday. So exceeding their expectations and around workplace tools, and you will be a hot place to work. You'll be the place that the best and brightest talent wishes to go to. It's more than just what cool toys do I have to play with on my PC or in my internet portal. These are the types of individuals who like to feel that they're contributing, who like to feel that they're valuable, and who like to feel that they're highly productive. And if you give them the tools to be highly productive in the manner that they're accustomed, then they will stick around and choose to grow their careers within your organization. And I think that that's a, you know, that like I said, that it goes a little bit deeper than a lot of people realize. Sometimes we talk about, hey, these kids today, they're coming on board, and they seem to already, know their way around our corporate internet before our intranet before we even showed them around, and it seems like they were born with a mouse in their hand, and we kind of chuckle and ha. The fact of the matter is, all of that is true, and the way that it's playing out is the best and brightest are going to the companies that can give them the sense that they are the most productive. And you need to be one of those companies if you wish to attract the top talent who today is 25, tomorrow or the next 5 years they'll be 30. And as those people move up the value chain and get their promotions and move into management positions and eventually upper management and executive positions, you want those people with your company through that tenure. And I think that that's a very important point to make.
I guess there's this common aspect that, the generation coming up, they have a richer experience with technology sometimes outside of the workplace than at the workplace, and they're very much accustomed to having a personalized work experience. So I take it you're really saying that you need to address those kinds of trends.
It's true, and there are ways to meter that or to measure it as well, and one of the I don't want to sort of scare your audience too much, but one of the ways that I like to describe measuring it is think of the difference between you and a generation older than you. Think of all of the things just as simple as programming a VCR or having a mobile phone that's also data enabled, your BlackBerry device, for instance, or trying to explain to grandma that she can get her email from anywhere in the world, that her computer isn't an actual mailbox that she has to be sitting in front of in order to retrieve her email. The difference between our generation and the generation older than us is often seen as almost exasperatingly behind the times in their ability to understand and contemplate technology. Now, when we look at the generation younger than us, we don't yet know just how smart they are, right? We tend to look at the generation that's older than us and say, oh, they're way behind the times, but we've more or less been able to keep up with the generation younger than us. I would argue that's not at all true. The generation younger than us is, and I'm using us very broadly, that's different for each individual, of course, but as you look at the, age 25 and below, they're looking up at the, age 35 to 55 group and saying, wow, these guys really don't get it. And fact is, we don't. We need to evolve our thinking to align to what the younger folks already know to be true in terms of efficiency and workplace environment.
Jeff, we're at this point in the interview where I'm going to turn it around and What questions would you ask if you were the interviewer, and what would be your answers as the interviewee? In other words, if you were doing this interview, what kind of questions should have I've asked you, and what would be your answers?
So I would probably want some clarification about next generation workplace as a term and where Avanade fits in that, how, you know, potentially how we differentiate ourselves in that space, especially since I've, you know, sort of alluded to the fact that all of these are technologies that are available today. I'll answer that by saying that NGWP is an offering that was established by Accenture, Avanade, and Microsoft, or what we sometimes call the power of three. So I think I mentioned earlier that Avanade is a joint venture between Accenture and Microsoft, and when those three companies get together and take a concept or a solution to market, we call it sort of a power of three solution. And, you know, clearly Accenture brings, you know, the industry knowledge, the business acumen, the process reengineering, journey management, even things like human performance management and strategy. Those aspects of Accenture's management consulting, process consulting, strategy consulting, and so forth. Microsoft brings, in our opinion, the best tools to the market for the enterprise today. They're the most cost-effective, they're innovating the most quickly, and they have the best product set to deliver on many of the next-generation messaging and communication concepts. And then Avanade sort of sits in between those two. As we take the light of Accenture's business processes and industry knowledge, and we shine that light upon Microsoft's technology stack, it then tends to illuminate a set of solutions that really make a lot of sense for our target customer group. And Next Generation Workplace is one of the solutions that was gleaned from us thinking about what do people need for next generation workplace technologies, looking at the Microsoft current set of available technologies, combining those in a manner that is consistent and provides a real value, and really what we're looking for here is where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and then, you know, putting together an information campaign to sort of share with people how that works and why they should enlist the help of Accenture, Avanade, and Microsoft to do it. And then the other question that I would probably ask myself is, following that question, I'd want to know how I'm able to live with myself after such a shameless plug of Avanade services. If you believe what you're saying, it's not so much a plug, it's really just sharing good news, and that's kind of the way we look at NGWP.
Jeff, we talked about this about a year ago, and that is there's this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, and they launched an initiative called IP3, or I should say the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is launching a global certification of professionalism program in 2009. And tied to that is this also accreditation program. And since a year ago, Avanade has now become an official sponsor of this program here in Canada. Can you talk more about your thoughts about this initiative?
Sure. One of the things that I'd like to add is that, Avanade does not often sponsor these types of programs. We're actually very selective in where we choose to engage. And I believe the reason for that is because there are really two types of certifications out there, and those are driven by two different, very different motivations. One type is a revenue-generating opportunity for the certifying body. I think we've all seen our fair share of those. The other, and the type that, you know, that we all feel is probably a little bit more appropriate, are truly interested in industrializing software and information technology processes in such a way that we're really adding a sense of professionalism to what it is we do in a measurable and consistent manner. And I think that's a big part of what IFIP attempts to accomplish, or the International Federation of Information Processing. They're attempting to bring a broad professionalism and global consistency to what it is we do, and what many would say is today a relatively loose science, or in some people's opinion, even sometimes more art than science. Over the course of the next couple of months, actually coming up toward the end of August, the I3P is, or the International Professional Practice Program, so it's I followed by three Ps, but they abbreviate I3P. They're coming to the Greater Toronto Area and then doing a tour throughout the rest of Canada, and they're going to be visiting the CIPS process, or the Canadian Information Processing Society, I believe. So they're going through CIPS' current process, and basically the end goal of this is to give CIPS the ability to have an accredited certification. So presently we can certify people under CIPS, but going forward we would like that certification to be internationally accredited by the I3P and therefore by the IFIP. So that's a lot of alphabet soup. Let me break it down a little bit further. We're asking that the Canadian certification be internationally recognized. We believe that that's a level of professionalism that Canadians deserve, that gives us an objective measure and a manner to compare ourselves to one another. And I think that all of the top talent-driven organizations in information technology throughout Canada should be very, very eager to see this go forward. And then, toward the end of August, we expect that accreditation to be completed via the site visit and via the evaluation of our process, our certification process here in Canada. And our hope then is that we're able to have internationally recognized IT professionals within the calendar year.
Well, it's an amazing initiative, and by the way, I believe they call it now IP3, so the International Professional Practice Partnership. So a slight rebranding of the initials there.
Okay. Well, thank you for the correction.
So again, it's just a remarkable achievement in terms of this international body, which is also an official UNESCO consultative group, and that Avanade has also indicated their support, and it speaks to professionalism, to professional certification, to continuing professional development. And it also speaks to Avanade in that they're willing to provide this kind of support. Well, we've come to the close of this interview, and Jeff, we will continue to follow your significant contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time with them and accumulated deep insights with us. You've been on the world stage for some time, weaving a historical mosaic of significant impact, and again, I hopefully you'll agree to another podcast, perhaps in 6 months, something like that.
It would be my pleasure, Stephen. Thanks very much for having me.